Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Hi there and welcome to the programme. I'm Declan Ralph.
And I'm Dave Daly.
Coming up on the programme today, in a moment, myself and Dave will be discussing some recent business headlines from the local and national papers. In the business of this week, I'll be talking with Robert Murphy from Ballymun for Business, who are promoting organisations and businesses in their area. This week, Brian Green will be here again to tell me of the progress he's making with his own business venture, Radio.ie, that he formally launched here with us 2 weeks ago. David Bell from the HR department will be here after that for his regular look at HR issues. And this week, a look at the difference between freelancers and employees from an employer's point of view. Finally then, a look at what supports are available to a new business startup. Now, if you would like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories, you can contact the show by text while we're on the air to 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. You can get in touch as well anytime on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Dave, we're going to look at some stories this evening, and the first one you have there is one about the Icelandic bankers, who seem to have a harder time of it, let's say, than what happened here at home.
Yeah, I see. Irish, British and American bankers who brought the world's economy to its knees in 2008 have barely faced the consequences for their actions. But in Iceland, it's a different story. The Nordic nation, which was one of the worst affected by the financial crisis in 2008, has sentenced 26 of its bankers to a combined 74 years in prison. In two separate rulings last week, the Supreme Court of Iceland and Reykjavik District Court sentenced six top managers of two national banks for crimes committed in the lead up to the banking sector's collapse, and bringing the total number of people who have faced the music for the roles in the crash to 26. At the moment, the maximum penalty for white-collar crime in Iceland is 6 years. Iceland deregulated its financial sector in 2001, and manipulation of the markets by bankers led to the system-wide meltdown when the global economy tanked in 2008. Iceland's economy is now in a comparatively good condition since the country has was forced to borrow heavily from International Monetary Fund 7 years ago. As Iceland's president Ulfar Ragnar Grimsson said when asked how the country recovered so quickly, he said, "We are wise enough not to follow the traditional prevailing orthodoxies of the Western financial world in the last 30 years. He said, "We introduced currency controls. We let the banks fail, which is something we didn't do here. And we provided support for the poor. We didn't introduce austerity measures like you were seeing across Europe. In the US, Ireland and the UK, of course, we just bailed them out."
Yeah, and it seems to have worked for them, as he said. Their economy is growing again, and they've taken a less traditional route, I suppose, as he said, than the rest of the Western world here.
Yes, and on to our next story now. And this is of interest to people, high flyers like yourself, Declan, I would imagine. him of Independent News and Media, Dennis O'Brien, has taken delivery of a brand new aeroplane, a $70 million corporate jet, which is the Gulfstream G650. Which he could accommodate 16 passengers, flies up to at 600 miles per hour, and was registered in the Isle of Man last week before flying to Dublin ahead of a trip to Luton. There was particular interest in the plane's livery, should I say, which includes the Irish tricolour on its tail above the lettering on its Manx registration. However, people were interested to know why it had an Irish flag when it was actually registered in the Isle of Man, which is a British controlled island, and it had the Irish flag on it. Irish registered planes, for example, bear the lettering EI. Yeah. The lettering on Mr. O'Brien's new Manx registered plane is MYGIG, my gig, nearly. There's a source that said there's no legal requirement whatsoever to have any national flag painted onto a plane. The convention, which the aviation industry, however, is often to include the national flag of the plane's operator. And Mr. O'Brien, of course, is an Irishman, and he obviously chose to apply the tricolour onto his plane. But the inclusion is just an optional part of the plane's livery, and it's not part of its formal registration procedure.
Interesting. Well, I have an interesting story about Dennis O'Brien and his private jet in the past. Do you want to hear it?
Go ahead.
We were down at a conference in County Kilkenny, and Dennis O'Brien was one of the speakers, but there was also some other speakers there at it, and somewhere over from the UK. And there was a particular lady there who didn't know who Dennis O'Brien was, And Dennis said to her in the green room afterwards, so to speak, he said to him, he said, I won't mention her name, we'll just call her Mary, let's say, for the moment. He said, Mary, would you like a lift? He said, I'm heading your way. And she said, oh, no, no. She said, the company have been very good. They've got a taxi here for me. They're taking me to the train station and that'll take me back to Dublin. And they have and also booked the flight for me back to London. And he said, fair enough. He said, but I'm going your way if you want to come with me. You know, it might be a little quicker. She said, no, thank you for your offer. But it's been very good of the company to, you know, organise all this transport for me. So Dennis went off on his helicopter to Dublin, grabbed the private jet to London, and the young lady was reeling afterwards when we explained it all to her.
There you go. Do you want a lift in my jet?
Okay, Dave, we'll take a break there from the news stories for a moment and we'll move on to the next part of the programme.
The Business Of on Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM.
I'm joined now by Robert Murphy. Robert is the chairperson of Ballymun for Business. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Declan. How are you?
Very good. Robert, I suppose the first thing for those who may not know what Ballymun for Business is, what is it?
Okay. We're a business networking group, Declan, set up around about 25, 26 months ago in the Ballymun area. Really focusing on getting local businesses to network with each other, to do business with each other, and to be involved with the community locally and to be involved with local organisations, and to drive footfall really in the Ballymun area and to drive business and promote business in a positive light. That's really what we're doing with Ballymun for Business.
Okay, and you've a number, in fact, you've a wide variety of businesses and organisations involved. Can you give me a feel for the type of organisation, the type of business that's involved there in the initiative?
Yeah, we've a wide range of businesses and different types of businesses. Really, we start with, you know, Musgrave's Cash and Carry would be one of our very active members. Metro Hotel in Ballymun there on the main street. Rediscovery Centre on the main street there in Ballymun. We've St. Vincent de Paul, who's up on Sloe Road, who would be an active member as well with the group. We've Innovate Dublin. It's a business social enterprise based in the Civic Building in Ballymun, and then they would also have various businesses located in their business that would be part of our network as well. So it's a wide variety of businesses, very diverse, but again, you know, always the sums of all parts really add up to a greater equal, and we're doing business with each other. We're open for business, and we're generating more business between ourselves.
Exactly. And I suppose one thing that's important in business, you should say, is to support one another, but also the kind of the business of networking and, you know, chatting to people involved in the area and involved in different businesses in the area. So, and I believe you run some events in that regard.
Yes, that's right. Like, one of our recent events would be GDPR event there recently, and just educating your members really on what's coming up, the changes, and with the way we hold information and customers' profiles and that kind of stuff, and you know, just making sure that we're going to be compliant with that going forward. We've run a lot of events over the last couple of years, and again, really just homing back to the networking piece. People spending 15, 20 minutes talking to each other, finding out what kind of business they're involved in, and just doing business with each other. We've a lot of success stories in relation to people, you know, from initial intro, couple of conversations, and then starting to do business with each other. Or you know how it is yourself. You know somebody that can help out in that department there or that area there, and it's leads and referrals, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and excellent. Yeah, so it's helping one another, helping the businesses, and it's great to see a positive initiative in that regard. And I mean, you're supported as well, I see, by Dublin City Council, Dublin Northwest Area Partnership, and also AIB are giving you a little support as well. So how does all that work?
Yeah, we've been very, very lucky over the last couple of years to be supported by the three organisations that you've mentioned. And in fairness, it's all been financial support, because you know it takes a lot of money to hold our meetings, to put on events like that. Like, gone are the days where you can half do an event. So if we're holding an open event, it's, you know, it does cost money, even for refreshments, and you know, this IT equipment would need to be used, and you'd need an MC for the event. And these organisations have put their hand in their pocket and are helping us out in relation to the financial cost of running Ballymun for Business, which is helping to get all the local businesses together. So, I do think the organisations, AIB, Dublin Northwest Area Partnership and Dublin City Council, do see the value in what we're doing locally and see the positive aspect that we're showing from a business point of view in the Ballymun area.
And I suppose with the whole regeneration of the area, I mean, there's lots of new businesses developing. You can see it as you pass up and down through Ballymun. But I suppose one question is, there was to be a lot more redevelopment. Is there any update on some of those projects in the area?
Yeah, and another great aspect of being involved with Ballymun for Business is really that we're very close to the ground, and we generally hear a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of planning decisions, planning applications, through our involvement with the group. And you know, we hear firsthand if a proposal is going before Dublin City Council, and so it's really great from you know, having a finger on the pulse in relation to what's happening in Ballymun. I would like to say that I'm sure my fellow members would agree that things are starting to happen in the area. As we all know, the Dublin economy is doing very well, and Ballymun is starting to get off the ground again. And you know, there has been a good few years of nothing happening, really, not just in Ballymun, but in a lot of areas in the city. But there has been a few key, you know, granting of planning permission for Lidl in Ballymun, and 363 apartment units, and that planning application has been approved. We also hear Decathlon coming up beside IKEA there on land further north outside Ballymun, which will have a knock-on effect to employment in Ballymun.
Sure.
You know, and yeah, so there is a lot of, there's a couple of roads being realigned in the Ballymun area. And then of course we have, you know, which was a great decision for Ballymun over a year ago, which was the co-op housing in the Ballymun area, and they're also looking for additional houses to construct for affordable homes, which will attract people that are really willing to set up shop and, you know, set up home in Ballymun and invest in the area. So yeah, there's a lot of great stuff happening in the Ballymun area.
Yeah, it's good. And you mentioned there earlier, one of your members is the Metro Hotel. Unfortunately, the fire that would be is well known right across the country, not just across Ballymun and the north side, but that has sort of set them back a little bit in the interim, which I'm sure is not helping some people who were probably employed there locally.
Yeah, it's been really, really unfortunate for them. And as I said, we've held some of our networking events in the Metro Hotel. Kate Kirby would be the marketing manager there, and Mark Williams, the manager. And the staff have always been fantastic to us. And yeah, it's just really, really unfortunate. And they just renovated their own premises, the bar area and the restaurant, and I think they were starting to go through the different floors in relation to renovating. So they were raising their own standards and over the last couple of years, and for something like that to happen. But I would have to say I spoke to Mark and Kate a couple of times, and you know, the can-do attitude they have to get back to business and get back to looking after customers and employing local people is second to none, and we do wish them very, very well. And you know, I know just from talking to other businesses in the area, we would have been there for to support the guys in anything we can do from a local business point of view.
Yeah, as you say, hopefully they'll be back in business sooner rather than later. And I mean, if people want to get involved in the organisation, you know, in the Ballymun for Business initiative, or whether it's an organisation locally that might be listening, or a business that might, you know, probably saying, I must get involved in that, but I just haven't got around to it. What's the best way for people to get in touch with you, Robert?
We've got a couple of different platforms, really, for getting in touch with us. You know, we have a very, very good website. We invested in there over the last couple of months, and the website has come on leaps and bounds over that time. But the website's very visible there, ballymunforbusiness.ie, and you can check all the different areas out on the website, and there is contact details there. We're also on Facebook as well, and you know, a private message on Facebook can certainly start the ball rolling. And I would urge local organisations or local businesses and to be involved and get involved. It won't hurt your business, definitely not. And there is opportunities there. And as I said, we've some great stories of great feedback from our members in relation to doing business with each other and growing their own business.
Well, look, can I wish you the best of luck with it? It's a fantastic initiative. Lots of local organisations and local businesses involved, as you said. And if people want to get in touch, as you said, you're on Facebook, you're on Twitter, and you've a very good website. I had a look at it myself earlier as well. It's a very, very good one indeed. So, Robert Murphy, chairperson of Ballymun for Business, thanks a million for taking the time to talk to me this evening.
Nearby Business on 90.3 Near FM with Declan Ralph and Dave Daly.
Brian Green has been with us from the very start of Nearby Business, and Brian has been out on the road for much of that time. But in the very first programme, when I was introducing Brian to you, I introduced him as a local entrepreneur. And that has now come to pass. Brian has set up his own business, radio.ie, and we're following Brian's progress. Good evening, Brian.
Good evening. How are you doing? I don't like the entrepreneur tag for some reason. It doesn't it's a monogram that doesn't sit well with me.
Doesn't sit well. But sure, is that not what a person who sets up business is, an entrepreneur?
Probably, yeah. But I don't know. It's very kind of, I don't know, startup kind of thing. And I don't think every business that starts is a startup.
Okay. Well, sure. We'll describe you then as a man who wants to do his own thing. How about that?
That sounds a little bit more like me, yeah.
That's more like you. Okay, so look, remind us, we're going to follow you over the next couple of weeks to see how the business is going. So just remind people again what the business is and give us a little feel for progress to date.
Yes, yeah, so it's a consultancy and it's called radio.ie. So it's radio consultancy, and I'm consulting to new entrants into the radio space. So not consulting to any of the existing radio stations. And I find myself setting this up coming off the back of some short-term unemployment. And about 9 months unemployed, I'm on the back-to-work enterprise allowance. And that is running for the next 2 years. And under that, I am setting up my business.
Okay. And give us a feel for how it's going so far. Have you earned any money yet? You launched it 2 weeks ago with us now on Nearby Business. So how's it been going since then?
Well, it's early days. And I said last week I've set my first invoice, and that was in advance of some work I'm going to do. So that work is in progress now. So it's always good to get the money up front, but then you have to go and do the work. So the work's happening at the moment. And last week we launched, I say we, but it's, you know, in radio.ie it's just one person. I was involved in launching Shining Bright Radio, which is the first project that I've been involved in off the back of this kind of new direction to setting up radio stations. And it's been enormous because it's the first week and we started with about 14, 15 programs. We're now up to 17 programs and, yeah, gathering listeners all the time.
Brilliant. So a bit of a momentum there in terms of that particular project. And obviously then the work you've got to do for the money you've got paid. So you're moving along nicely. I suppose as well, Brian, given that when you know you've set up the business now, but you never stop learning really, and you never stop looking for help in business. And you're going to undertake another course over the next 2 years as part of the development of your business.
Yeah, I'm looking at the course application here and I have applied for it, and it's 104 weeks and it's probably the longest course, as I look at it in week numbers, that I've ever applied for. And it's 2 years and it's with the training centre in Baldoyle. It's called Thrive Business Growth Programme.
Excellent. Yeah, that's the Thrive Business Growth Programme.
Yeah, and so it's 2 years, but it's very, it's not sitting in a training centre every week or even every day or anything like that. It's just kind of very much you go off and run your business, but every now and again, every couple of weeks, you get together with the group that are on the course and they mentor you through the 2 years, your first 2 years of existence. So think of it like incubation, but they don't give you a premises to live in all the time. So we'll do boot camp training, and we'll do workshops and mastermind training. The board you can't afford, so we'll have people helping me kind of grow the business as my board, even though they're not my board, but that they're like board people. And lots of peer kind of interaction and assistance and help and networking opportunities over the 2 years.
Okay, so the board you can't afford, I like that. What would you say in terms of what you need to get out of here? I mean, if you examine your own skills, what would you say are your strengths and weaknesses? Some of us are, you know, obviously you know the technical stuff, but would you say you're a marketeer? Would you say you're better on the finance? Which side do you think you're going to need the most guidance on?
Probably on the finance, and it's, the kind of consultancy isn't kind of anything industrial or heavy and needs a lot of upfront payments. It doesn't need a lot of plant, it doesn't need a lot of office space, it doesn't need a lot of machinery. It's, you know, who you can meet and what deals you can do, and a lot of my work is done solo on a computer. It's also, you know, getting suppliers and buying equipment and selling it on and that kind of stuff. But in the main, it's going to still be financial, even though it's not all those things. It is the kind of the day-to-day, the banking, the watching the bottom line. That, for me, is something I'd have to grapple with and get good at to be good in business.
And have you thought about, sort of, I suppose, in even in large corporate business, they call it key man dependencies. I mean, you mentioned there that at the moment, even though you're looking and sounding bigger with we, that there is just Brian, and you are the key man when it comes to radio.ie. So what would the plan be if you're, you know, if you're not feeling a little under the weather or whatever? How are you going to deal with that? Have you thought about it?
Yeah. That came up. I did, so last October, November, I did a 10-night Start Your Own Business course, and that does come up. So the key thing there is that, you know, to stave off the absolute inevitable where you're too ill to work for a period of time, you've got to go for the insurance, and you've got to pay out of the bottom line and, you know, pay for insurance for those rainy days when you cannot work. Because if you're it and you're providing for you or other people, and the money has to come in, or you have no money to live on. So yeah, it would be insurance in situations like that.
Yeah, I suppose it's something that you have to consider as well. You have to sort of mind yourself a little bit as well, and watch the signs that and I suppose that's why it becomes important not to work 24/7. I mean, everybody's very keen when they start a new enterprise to, you know, put their best effort into it. But it is important to take breaks as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And there's another way of looking at it. If you were going for tenders, you couldn't really fulfill a tender as one person. So you can collaborate with other groups, other companies and other projects, bring your skills to them as a consultant, and have the broader number of people in that company be the face of what's going forward in a tender situation, because a one-person operation just isn't going to do it.
Yeah, and that the old adage of the smoke and mirrors, you know, making everything look a little bit bigger than it actually is.
Yeah, or actually making it bigger than it actually is, actually doing it, because the question does come down to the solo operator, you know, well, what if you get hit by a bus?
Yeah, very true.
And then you're going to go, yeah, I've thought of that, and here's my answer. This is what I've just given you.
Brilliant. Well, Brian, look, we're going to keep in touch with you over the next few weeks on Nearby Business, and as I said to you at the very start, the best of luck with the business, and we'd be delighted to keep in touch with you and talk to you and hear what's happening as you progress over the next few weeks.
Thanks, Declan.
Thanks a million. That's Brian Green there. Radio.ie is his business. That's also his website domain, and you can get in touch with him that way. And thanks a million again to Brian for that. Okay, David, another interesting story you've come across this week is one about horse tablets.
Yeah, teenage sisters Kate and Annie Madden, the pair's horse supplement company, Finu Health, already exports to 15 countries, and now they're going to open an office in England in response to Brexit. They're based in Meath, and they have a main product called Finu Save, and it's used for the prevention and treatment of gastric ulcers in horses. The products are manufactured just outside London, and they're categorised as a feedstuff, and they can be fed to a horse right up to and on the day of a race. So obviously, there's doping issues with horses and the things
you give
them.
Yeah.
This is a natural product. And because of Brexit, they say we're planning on setting up an office near to where it's manufactured, said Annie, and she is 15 and she's in transition year. And she says, this is great. It's much easier to have a main distribution hub in Britain when we're trying to deliver it instead of all the extra documents that will be brought in soon. So they know something we don't about Brexit.
So. Yeah, fair play.
They say it'll cut out all the paperwork and it'll make Britain a lot more accessible after Brexit. They're actually in 15 countries, and going forward, we're always trying to expand. In 5 years, there's no reason why we can't be in 150 countries, Annie said. The company was set up by the sisters, who won a prize in the 2015 BT Young Scientist competition. It's developed 8 products, but at the moment it's focused on pushing 3 products to ease the horse stomach problems. The company has some high profile clients. After he won the Melbourne Cup, trainer Joseph O'Brien endorsed Finu Health. They said it's great for the business when a customer come out and say they have used it, and he said. The company is profitable, according to the sisters, but they would not disclose the figures. Back in 2015, we started with a loan from Bank of Mum and Dad, and we've no debts to date. We are started off when we needed the money from somewhere, but they've been totally all paid back, Annie said. So her sister, the two girls are, as I mentioned, Katie and Annie Madden. Annie is 15 and Katie is 17, and she's doing her leavings there. They said, we knew how to ride horses before we knew how to walk, and they certainly know how to run a business.
They sure do.
Well
done to Katie and Annie, and I hope there was no pun intended when she said the main office would be in the UK. It reminded me of, I just wondered if there's any application for this medicine in humans, because I don't know if you've heard recently, there's a lot of talk about the horse shampoo, which is actually called mane and tail, and they discovered that it is absolutely fantastic for human hair. And now they sell it in pharmacies right up and down the country. So there you go. Coming up in the next half hour, David Bell with his regular look at HR issues from the employer's point of view. And this week we're going to look at the pros and cons of freelancers versus full-timers. And also a feature on what supports are available to anyone setting up a new business locally. Don't forget as well, if you'd like to get involved in the discussion or comment on any of the stories at any time while the show is on the air, you can use the text line 087 69 44 500. That's 087 69 44 500. Or you can get in touch anytime on Twitter at @nearby_business, #localbiz.
Your HR questions answered on Nearby Business.
David Bell joins me now for his usual weekly look at HR issues. This week we're going to look at the benefits and the differences of hiring a freelancer versus hiring a full-timer. Good evening, David.
Evening, Declan.
David, how do you describe a freelancer in the first place? How does somebody, you know, that works in this way, how would you describe them?
Yeah, I suppose, as you say, freelancer, other people, contractor would be another expression. Yeah, so basically it is someone who is self-employed, who a business takes on for either a project or on a more, semi-permanent to provide a service. to that business. So atypically, a lot of people in the IT business would be contractors. So they might work in the business, but they actually are self-employed, and they usually invoice the company for the amount of time they spend working in the business, either on a particular project or on a day-to-day basis. But they generally have their own business. They're self-employed. They register themselves for probably VAT and tax purposes, and they issue an invoice to the business based on the hours that they have worked.
And why typically would a business take on a freelancer rather than, say, giving someone either a part-time or a full-time job, I suppose?
Yeah, well, I suppose they tend to be, and they have a specific expertise in an area, or they are just an expertise. So sometimes you don't necessarily know what you want to have in terms of an employee, but you know you have a particular requirement for a certain level of expertise. And rather than maybe trying to find that person when you don't know exactly what you want, you can I suppose bring a contractor in. It's not as permanent perhaps as obviously bringing an employee in. They generally have a fairly good level of experience in what they're doing, so there isn't much training or bedding in required at all. So they can usually just, as they say, hit the ground running. And then you can probably have a look and see if that particular arrangement works out. That's great. And if not, it might highlight more what you actually need. Is it someone slightly different? Is it a different skill set? Is it someone that doesn't require the experience that the contractor might have? So it's often where you either don't know what you want, or that you only required for a period of time or for a project that you hire in a freelancer or a contractor.
Okay. And David, what sort of responsibilities does an employer have to a freelancer? Is it similar to the responsibilities they'd have to an employed person?
No. I mean, generally the terms and conditions, there will be some form of contract or an agreement drawn up, often provided by the contractor. So they would have their terms and conditions. You would then, as the person in taking on the contractor, you might have your own. So I mean, where this actually it sort of asked another question as well, in the sense that where this becomes an issue is where a contractor, so there's two ways a contractor can be deemed to be an employee. One might be from a revenue perspective, so the revenue will look and see whether the person is actually an employee, and they have a set of guidelines that they have published. And they will look at the relationship. So the things they look out for are, you know, is the who controls the relationship? Is the contractor coming on every single day at the same time every day? Do they bring their own equipment? So again, in a building situation, you would be arriving with your own tools, or are you provided with tools? In the IT, do you come with your own laptop? Do you come with your own phone? Or do you provide anything like that? So the more control that you have as an employer or as a company over a contractor, that potentially could result in either the revenue deeming them to be an employee, or if you did have an issue maybe down the line and you terminated the contract on the basis, well, look, you're a contractor, I only need to give you 1 month's notice, I don't have to go through any disciplinary or grievance or anything of that nature because you're a contractor and it's merely we're parting company. Sometimes the contractor, depending on the relationship, might say, actually, you know, I've been doing this for 2 years every day.
Yeah.
I think I actually could be an employee for all intents and purposes. And they will challenge their right to take a case under the Unfair Dismissals Act, because you have to be an employee to have the benefit of that act. So the type of thing that you would look at if I was asked to determine whether someone is an employee or a contractor, things like that. So do they have their own professional indemnity insurance? Can they get someone else to do the job? In other words, if they can't do it, can they hire someone in? Does it have an end date? You know, does it an ongoing relationship, or does it sort of, you know, it's come to the end of its life? So they're the sort of things you look at. Control is really one of the main things. Is do they determine their own hours? Is it just a case of when they can do it? Can they work for other people? Are they exclusive to you? So things like that. The more control you have over the person, potentially, that person could be deemed to be an employee.
And of course, from an employer's point of view, there's generally more flexibility, as you said, in hiring a freelancer rather than having somebody employed directly by the company. But in terms of reliability, would a freelancer be generally more reliable or less reliable? Or how would you actually, if they're not, say, on your premises, how would you even know have they, you know, engaged in a productive day for you?
Yeah, well, I suppose, again, I think you try and be very specific in what you require. And, you know, if you take it in its purest form, if you have an employee that you're paying a salary, you can't really not pay them the salary because they might have dropped a couple of days or they were out sick or they didn't hit the targets that you wanted. Okay, there are different processes that you can go through, but deducting money off them is not one of them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you have a contractor and they have certain targets and they're being paid an hourly rate or a daily rate and they don't work for you and the work is not being done, well, then I suppose you don't have the obligation to pay them. So they tend to be more reliable in the sense that they get paid per project or they get paid per day. And if they fail to reach the targets or reach the sort of the deadlines that you've instilled or you've agreed with them, then they could suffer a loss. So they tend to be more focused in that sense, that they tend to work to a daily rate or an hourly rate, which is a bit more specific than just getting a salary, because a salary does cover you. You know, often if you're not performing at your best, you're still getting paid.
Yeah.
So I think from a reliability generally, and I suppose most contractors, as I say, they have an expertise, they know what they're doing. They should be more productive than perhaps someone who's maybe quasi-learning on the job or starting to get into the role. Contractors generally have a level of expertise that means they don't have any of that, and they can pretty much get into a project or get into a task fairly quickly.
And you mentioned IT there as an example of an area where there might be freelancers or contractors. Are there certain industries where it's more the norm to have contractors and freelancers than others?
No, I think IT is probably the most traditional one, but I suppose, you know, in what they call the way the world has gone with the recession, a lot of people ended up setting up on their own because the jobs weren't available.
Yeah.
And some it proved very successful. So a lot of businesses now are looking at what can be outsourced. So, for example, without blowing our own trumpet, we provide, you know, outsourced HR. There's a lot of people doing in the finance side of things. So you might have an outsourced financial controller. You know, people obviously outsource their payroll. So there's a lot of tasks nowadays that people look at, marketing, PR, that they don't want to or don't need to take someone on an employment basis, that they can actually, and I suppose it can be a cost saving, because while you're paying maybe a bit over their odds on a fee basis, you know, you don't have the additional paying PRSA and PAYE. You don't have I suppose it potentially could be a liability having an employee if the project comes to an end. You don't have to look at redundancy payments and things like that. So, you know, I think a lot of things, particularly for smaller businesses, they are looking at, rather than bringing it in-house, they are looking at outsourcing it in the first instance, just to see. But you can get, as I say, fairly high-level expertise at a relatively reasonable cost. And then you're not committed to someone and trying to find work. You can do it on a project basis or an ongoing basis. And it probably is easier to end the relationship if it's an employee. So I think a lot of businesses are looking at it.
Yeah, I think, as you say, marketing, social media, and it may be that you just need it for a campaign or for a particular issue, not necessarily there full time. So perhaps you can get better value for money that way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. It's a very interesting subject, again, as usual, the freelancer versus the full-timer or the employee. And as usual, David, you've done a great job of explaining it to us. Thanks a million for that.
Thanks, Declan.
Business supports on Nearby Business.
We met with a number of people who have made the break into self-employment. We also spoke to the two main banks about how to go about setting up on your own and the supports available. Businessman and small business mentor Andy Pettibridge advises us and gives us some useful guidance.
I think the first step is to look at the product that you have and decide, look, is this something that will sell? Have I done enough research? Do I understand my competition? All of those things.
So you decide to leave your job and go out on your own.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
You have your own business. Tell us about why you went out on your own.
I was working in the finance industry and I was made redundant from that business. My husband and myself decided something that we'd always thought we might do was to start up a business on our own, which we did 17 years ago. So it is quite a challenging thing to do. You have very little support from outside. You're responsible for everything that comes in, everything that goes out. You know, payments to revenue and things like that have to always be made, regardless of whether you have the money coming in. And there's not that much support out there. On the other hand, you do have good days. You have the freedom to, you know, change the business if things are not going well, or if you want to change the direction. You know, having a small business and running it yourself makes things like that easier.
Eamon McGrattan tells us.
An entrepreneur is, they say an entrepreneur always has something going on. He's always thinking of something, kind of a monkey mind, you know, that jumping around thinking of things. So, I don't know, I never really wanted to work for people and don't like getting told what to do. So I decided to work for myself and it's worked out. But you do, it's a lot of stress to work for yourself because you take your problems home at night and, you know, I'd say you can be excited some nights thinking of, you know, good things and positives and green things and, you know, green shoots are appearing and things are picking up and that. And then you can't sleep because you're excited. And then you go to sleep and you can't sleep because you're worrying about how you're going to get paid and who's going to pay you and when's the money going to come in and where are you going to get men to do this and to do that and the subcontractors and everything else. So it's a double-edged sword working for yourself. But for me, I enjoy it. Now, I couldn't work in a conventional job or work for someone else and be told what to do.
Well, I started working for myself because I had worked for a number of companies over the years and then things had changed, new management come in. I always had a burning passion inside me, something that I wanted to achieve, and I wanted to do it before a certain age. So in my case, it was the age of 40. So I set about assembling a number of agencies in the area in which I worked and making the challenge on myself to get out and do it. It's a very difficult thing to do, go out on your own. You've no safety net effectively. You're throwing everything into the pile and you take it home with you. And at the weekends, you're thinking about it and you're on 24-hour sort of watch and call for what you're thinking about in your business. You have some great days, you have some bad days. You know, you have the best of days and you also have the worst of days. And you have to worry about cash flow and getting paid and will you get paid. And sometimes you will lie awake at night worrying about these things. And there is a certain freedom to it, though, and it does bring a great amount of freedom and reward. It can be difficult when you're a small business up against some big businesses, and it can particularly be difficult when maybe when things go wrong at certain times with a product or a service that you provide and you feel that you are being probably put upon because you're a small business. But other than that, it can be very rewarding, and it can be very nice too when people thank you and praise you for the work that you've done for them in completing a project or likewise.
Why did you start working for yourself in your own business?
Working with my brother. He set it up and I went along with him, and it was just young. I was just looking for something to do, and it was it went from there. It's good though.
Could you ever work for anyone else again?
No, I don't think so. Not at this stage. I'm too dyed in the wool, doing what I'm doing to go down that road, I think. You know what I mean? Just stick with it. Work hard. Do the hours. Determination and just stick with it, hold tough, and you know, just work hard, put the arrows in. There's no shortcuts with it.
AIB told us
You should contact your bank when you have the company set up or when you've registered the company with the company's registration office, because in that way then you can come into the bank and go by the procedure of opening a bank account.
We do an overall startup package. So if you're trading less than 3 years, and whether you be a sole trader or a limited company, first thing we'll do is we'll open up a bank account for you. So on that bank account, if you're a startup, if you qualify, you will get free banking for the first 2 years. You'll also get free internet business banking for the first 2 years. There is another option where you can either have IBB, which is for more detailed multi-users on the internet business banking for a large company, they're paying wages. If it's just a one-person company, which a lot of limited companies are one or two people, you can get one-user internet banking, which is free for the lifetime of having that facility. Every new startup should have a business plan, should have cash flow projections, especially if they're coming in looking for facilities. So say you wanted to get a loan for 10 grand equipment, the first thing I'll ask you for is a business plan and cash flow projections. It's a rich man's
world. Bank of Ireland told us.
It's good advice generally to approach a bank early on. The advantage of doing that is a lot of our business advisors talk to a number of people in business that have started business. We see a lot of what can go wrong. We see a lot of what can make things work really well. And when people talk to us early, we get the opportunity to share some of that information with them.
And what information would the bank need from a new business?
Yeah, good question. Depends on how much business support they're looking for. In the context of lending, to sum up, we would say we need everything. So it's the business, the projections, what revenue is going to be generated from that business activity. Within that, to reduce or minimise the risk for the institution, i.e. the bank, what's the element of personal input the promoter of that business is going to put into it? In our view, unless somebody is willing to put their money on the line, it's hard for us to justify us putting all of ours on the line as well. And that's where the balance of a personal input becomes very important. It sends the right signal to the bank where somebody's willing to put a significant personal input into the venture that they quite firmly believe in, because otherwise they wouldn't put their personal input in.
What facilities are on offer from the bank generally these days to startups?
Yeah, generally we try to ease the burden of setup costs for businesses by giving a preferential free banking treatment for 2 years. So they will not pay transaction fees for the first 2 years of establishment. We also provide our customers with 1 hour's consultation advice through a chartered solicitor or accountant. We give our customers access to our workbenches that are at various city locations in Dublin, Cork, Limerick and Galway.
Liz Carroll, ISMI.
ISMI is a group which represents small businesses in Ireland, and Liz is going to tell us a little bit about the value of being a member of a representative body.
Well, there are a large number of different representative bodies around the country in various different sectors. As Eve said, we represent SMEs. They're a huge part of the economy here. The advantages really depend on what the different bodies actually offer, I suppose. So from ourselves, we lobby on your behalf. We can save you money through our, it's like a group purchasing scheme, we call them discount affinity schemes. So say for your telephone, your insurance, your life assurance, you know, foreign exchange costs, things like that, you can reduce the costs to yourself. We also offer a number of different services. So as you said, I look after training and development. So we offer reduced price training to our members, and we also then offer a training and development service so we can source training, develop training, etc., specifically for your company. And we offer a HR advice. So mainly that tends to deal with employment law issues. A lot of people setting up their own companies have the skills in what they set up their business in, but not necessarily in running the business. So we provide advice and things like having your, you know, your contracts, what type of contracts you need, maternity leave, paternity leave, days off, you know, holiday entitlements, all of those kind of things.
I'm speaking to Andy Pretterbridge, who's a small business advisor, and Andy's going to speak to us today about some of the things you need to do when you're setting up a small business. Andy, firstly, can you start by telling us, what do people have to do when they get the idea and they want to start a small business? What's the first step they should take?
I think the first step is to look at the product that you have and decide, look, is this something that will sell? Have I done enough research? Do I understand my competition? All of those things. Have I got a supply line? Is it sustainable, basically? You know, can I see myself selling this product in 3, 4, 5 years time, or is it going to be taken over by technology or other things? So you've got to firstly start with that, you know.
So it's got to be, it has to have something that's marketable. It's got a little bit of longevity and so on. Okay, just in terms of capital for startups. So you say you set up a small business, you know, maybe it's a service industry, maybe it's something you're going to make widgets. Finances.
Yeah, very simply, I think before you do anything else, you start with a business plan. So you have to decide, you know, how much is it going to cost to start this business and keep it going, and particularly the first year. Most startups fail in year one or year two.
And so, that's due to sort of probably expectations greater than they were, unrealistic expectations, probably a failure to get cash flow through the business and so on. So maybe talk about the next bit there in terms of the key performance indicators and things people need to keep their eye on and what they're buying, how they're selling. Just those kind of ideas that they need to watch the figures. Introduce us to that, please.
Yeah, very simply, if you don't have a budget done from day one, the likelihood is your business is going to fail. So the first thing you've got to do is talk about the cost of the product and getting it to market and costing all of that out, and what margin you need to achieve in order to cover all your costs and to keep the business going and to move on from there. And, you know, employees, you know, how many people do you need to deliver the product? The partners that you have involved. I think an important part of the first stage of a startup is to get as much done pro bono, and that means free services. So you call on your friends and your colleagues and people you know in the business to get you off the blocks, basically. But it starts with a business plan and looking at the process. It's all the P's, really, Dave, to be honest with you. If you start with the process and the place where you do business. So are you going to work from home? You know, if you are going to work from home, will you be able to work from home? Is it viable? You know, can you make phone calls? Can you set up your IT from home? It's really important that the place from which you do business is conducive to doing business. A lot of companies, small companies, think it's just about selling the product and being paid. But there are, you know, there are important legalities around it too. You know, you can be sued if the product doesn't perform, for example. So it's all these little bits of advice. You need a bit of legal advice, you need a bit of accountancy advice and tax advice, and you need your business plan to be validated. Now, that's usually with a bank. People blame the banks for a lot of things, but one of the most important things is that if your business plan doesn't fly, they're not going to give you money. Nobody's going to give you money.
Our interviewees tell us why they think people start out on their own.
It's a double-edged sword working for yourself, but for me, I enjoy it. Now, I couldn't work in a conventional job or work for someone else and be told what to do.
You want to be your own boss. You want to change things. You know, if you have ideas yourself, then maybe, you know, you want to drive them forward, and you're working for somebody else, you know, they're in charge effectively, and, you know, ideas that you might have for growth may not be taken on board. Yeah, you do have the freedom as well to work, you know, longer hours or shorter hours, and things that maybe suit your family and your lifestyle.
A lot of people tell us that they like the by not having to answer to somebody, and they can have their own, work their own hours. So if they come home in the evening, they can actually, if they're out all day doing things, they can actually come home in the evening and log on and do their own accounts and that type of thing. So they like to be their own boss. They don't have to answer to anybody else. But also they enjoy it. They really enjoy the, a lot of people would open a business that they enjoy doing.
And sometimes you'll find that people might open, they might have been in that industry for years, and they know how it works, they've seen it, and they think, oh, I can do that, or I can do better. So they take the chance, they might get a redundancy or something like that. It gives them the opportunity, that push to say, okay, I'm going to do it myself. I know I can do it myself. I have the experience, so I'm going to take that leap.
I think there's a couple of things. It's another P, it's called passion. And I think it's something people say, God, I always wanted to do that. If I don't do it now, I'll never do it. I think that's one thing. I think the other thing is, you know, to have a bit of fun. It's exciting, it's risky. Entrepreneurs, I mean, the backbone of every entrepreneur is risk. They love taking risk. And sometimes you fail, but it's what you learn from those failures, however big or small they are, and how you come back from them. It's a challenge. It's like a football game. It's half time, you're 1-0 down. I can still win this game in the second half. And that's really what I think is the key thing. It's the passion, it's the fun, it's the uncertainty, and it's making a success out of something that you weren't quite sure you were going to make a success of. I think that, to me, is what the common bond is between small business people and big business people. It's the same thing.
Well, Dave, we're getting close to the end of the programme, and I'm getting a little bit hungry at this stage. And some good news for the gourmet food parlour business. They're about to open their 10th store on the north side of Dublin.
Indeed, they are. The catering and restaurant group Gourmet Food Parlour is to invest $250,000, opening its 10th business. The company, which was founded by Lorraine Heskin and Lorraine Byrne in 2006, have several restaurants, a deli bar and a catering business in Dublin. It will now open a new restaurant in Skerries, County Dublin in the summer, adding to its locations in Dundira, Malahide and Santry, as well as a house in the house in Leeson Street and 37 Dawson Street. Managing Director Heskin said the company has been waiting for the right opportunity to go to Skerries for a decade. 10 years ago, we were looking for a place on the north side. We were a year open in our cafe in Dunleary at the time. We went out to Skerries and it came down to Skerries and Swords. We went to Swords at the time, but we always felt that there was a real lovely feel to Skerries and there's a nice draw in terms of population around it. So we felt we might have some home there someday. This year then, a landlord approached the Gourmet Food Company with a building in Church Street, which used to be the Coast Inn. I remember the Coast Inn myself many years ago. It was a great attraction, a sort of a disco bar in the 80s. And it was a music bar, but it was a really nice place and it was kind of like being on your holidays when you went out to it.
It has a reincarnation recently called Raff's on the Corner, and they retained the Coast Bar as part of Raff's on the Corner, which lasted for a few years, but sadly went the way of many businesses.
Well, there you go. The plan is to reinstate the Coast Inn in Skerries and bring a part of that history back to the town. There was a restaurant attached to the pub, which is closed down a number of years ago. So Gourmet Food Parlour would set up there beside the bar, and they said that the place has a lovely history. Some 250,000 will be invested in the fit out in Skerries, and the restaurant will open by the end of June. The Gourmet Food Parlour, which has more than 220 staff, which is brilliant, is growing steadily. There's a hunger in the business, and the team keep maintaining the growth, Heskin said. There's a huge demand for food in Dublin, and people like to dine out and they like to enjoy the experience of dining. It's wonderful to be a part of all that. The company puts a lot of effort into marketing and promoting itself on social media, and as a way of setting its own food trends. And it works with the Dublin GAA, providing healthy meals for players during training sessions and camps, as well as pre- and post-match post matches. This year, the restaurant chain is branching into Ladies Gaelic Football Association, and it's the first organisation named as a title sponsor of the ladies' GAA competitions with the LGFA over the next 3 years.
Well, that's it for this week for Nearby Business. Thanks to all our contributors this evening. We'll both be back at the same time next week, but in the meantime, if you have a comment on any of the stories featured today, or you have an idea you'd like to discuss with us, get in touch on Twitter at @nearby_business #localbiz. So for now, from me, Declan Ralph,
and me, Dave Daly,
see you soon on the radio.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.